Hello, everybody, and welcome to Reason Town, episode 12. Today, we're going to talk about some error handling. We're going to talk about letting anything, which doesn't make sense, but it will later. And I'm here with Jared. You want to say hi, Jared?
Hello.
Jared Forsyth.
That's right.
It took me a second to remember the correct name of your last name. Today, we are sponsored by TylerMcGinnis.com. TylerMcGinnis.com provides our hosting for us, and TylerMcGinnis.com is the linear course-based approach to learning web technologies. Tyler McGinnis is a fantastic guy, and he does some good stuff. So please go check that out if you want to learn more about React, JavaScript, the web technologies in general. Also sponsored by my company, Day One. We make a journal, and I think you'll like it if you look at it. I like it a lot. I use it all the time at work and at home for my home stuff. And Jared, you work for Khan Academy. Do you want to put in a plug for Khan Academy at all?
Yeah. So Khan Academy, free world-class education for anyone, anywhere, is the goal.
Wow, that's like the best tagline you can have as a company.
Right. We haven't reached it yet, but we've got some pretty good stuff. If you want to learn things, we've got high school content, but also some college level. Like I'm trying to learn macroeconomics because I never took an econ class. So
I'd say more than some. I've mentioned this on the show before, but Khan Academy basically got me through college. So if you're in college and you haven't started looking at Khan Academy, you might get better grades if you do.
That's right.
So check that out. And yeah, great. I'm going to excuse my voice and my nose because I just got over a little cold, and I know it's gross to listen to someone who has a stuffy dose talking on the microphone. So I'm sorry for that. But we've got some fun stuff to talk about today. Why don't you kick us off, Jared?
All right. So since we last talked, the State of Reason survey finished. Just under 400 responses, 398.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
For a bleeding edge technology and community, yeah.
Right. So lots of thank you if you responded. We're still going through all the information. But one tidbit that I thought was interesting and kind of indicates a little bit about the state of the community. Of the people that use Reason, 47% said that they have helped somebody else learn Reason.
Interesting.
So that's a pretty high teacher rate, I feel like.
Yeah, I think so too.
So still very much in the phase of, you know, people are evangelists if they're using it because it's pretty bleeding edge.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Yep. But we will be crunching the numbers, doing analysis, and coming out with a blog post, hopefully within the next month or two.
So that'll be interesting to see what actually comes out of that. I mean, there's a lot of work to kind of go through the freeform responses, especially, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, and the things that I'm most interested are kind of slicing the responses by other things that we collected, right? Okay. So for the people that are, you know, have been using Reason for less than 3 months, what are the pain points versus people that have been using it for over a year?
Yeah, that makes sense. It's really interesting.
And, you know, of the people that are coming from TypeScript, what are the features that they most want versus people that are coming from OCaml or, you know, other things?
You know, it's funny because the syntax is designed to be JavaScript friendly, but I think that was the single biggest hurdle for me.
Yeah.
When I first started, was like, I spent the first couple of weeks just like hammering my head against the syntax, especially external.
Right.
So that, I mean, maybe it's because it was so strict with certain things, and there's a whole lot more to the syntax and Reason than there is in, say, Elm, for example.
Right.
Because Elm's a very small language.
Right.
But a lot less than you'd find in something like Scala, for example. So
totally.
It's a, kind of a toss-up because you get a lot more flexibility language-wise than you do with Elm. So it's a trade-off. But yeah, that was a big challenge. So if you're just learning and wondering why you can't understand the syntax yet, it's not a unique thing.
Right. It doesn't help that the syntax errors are super unhelpful most of the time.
Pretty cryptic. Yeah. You just have to know the syntax, go look at the place where the syntax error is and be like, all right, why am I dumb here?
Yeah. Right. And before you spend, you know, half an hour banging your head against it, jump on Discord, ask somebody.
Yeah.
There'll be people that are happy to help you.
They'll help you out.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So that's State of Reason survey. Stay tuned for more.
And did you want to talk about the editors? That's kind of interesting.
Oh yeah. This was fascinating. So, what was it? 65% of the respondents use VS Code. Makes sense, you know.
Right.
So, definitely the top. But in second place was Vim.
Not Adam.
Not Adam.
Adam was way down there.
Yeah, unexpected. Adam was third, but at only like 10%, whereas Vim had 14%.
It's pretty interesting. Is there even a language server plugin for Vim, or is this
there is.
Okay.
Yeah, you can use the OCaml language server or the Reason language server.
I was wondering if this was like Rob Pike people who were just like zero syntax highlighting, zero code support.
Right. No, Jordan Walk uses Vim, and so he's made sure that, you know, there's support for it.
Awesome. That's great.
Yeah.
I haven't used raw Vim in the terminal for a few years.
Yeah.
I mean, I use Vim bindings all the time in our newer editors, but I don't know. You know, there's something to be said for sticking to straight up Vim in the terminal with Tmux. There's a lot of power to be had there if you do it right, but there's also thousands of hours to be spent on your Vim config and your Tmux config.
Right. I still, like, just today I fired up Vim in the embedded terminal within VS Code.
Oh, yeah.
To just, like, there was a file that wasn't within my workspace that I just wanted to do a quick edit on.
That's my primary use of Vim. Is anywhere I'm not going to, like, pop open my real editor, I'm just Vim it. And on servers, of course.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
I'm grateful Vim is there. I'm glad it exists.
Yep.
Well, great. So let's talk a little bit about our favorite topic over the last like three episodes, Reason on the server.
Yeah. So tell us, what's the latest thing you've been wrestling with?
Well, we've come a long way from the first episode when we talked about this, where we said, don't do it.
Right?
Yeah. I'm, in fact, doing it heavily up to my ears now, and I've come to the conclusion that I like it. I think it's a...
Well, that's good.
I think it's a nice place to be. There are some pain points, though, and let me talk through a few of them and see if you have good advice for me, if the community has good advice for me, or if we can help clear this up for some other people.
Totally.
So JavaScript, if you're writing an Express server, the way you do error handling is kind of like I wouldn't say let it fail, but like you typically work with promises. You will either let a promise failure propagate up to the very top level,
right,
which will fail, do a 500 in your response, or you catch your promises along the way, and you can take the exception that you receive and print out the call stack,
right,
and you end up with a nice call stack that tells you, oh, this error came from this file at this line, and it says this. And that's pretty easy to debug,
right,
sometimes. Not as easy when it's like, undefined has no property foo, you know, and you're like,
right,
oh, shoot, where is that?
Right. Well, and these days, I mean, the JavaScript errors that I find most vexing, now that we have, you know, async support in tracebacks, but before we had that, any async errors were just a hot mess.
I still get that though.
but these days, the most difficult thing is there's a value that is inexplicably undefined, and it's been passed through, you know, for several call sites. I have to just start spewing out console.log.
And luckily, we don't get that much anymore with Reason.
Right, because it's got explicit optional.
Unless you've accidentally, you know, unless you've made some mistake or assumption at your borders.
Right.
You don't really.
If you haven't validated correctly.
Right. Or if you're cheating inside your code with object.magic, which is a thing
I have run afoul of.
People do.
Yeah.
Including me. Okay, so that's kind of the error handling idea in JavaScript. So if you're coming from JavaScript, which I have been, you would kind of expect a similar thing since we're based on top of JavaScript.
Right.
But OCaml, or Reason, is built to use OCaml exceptions.
Right.
And BuckleScript does this translation sort of OCaml exceptions-ish.
Yeah.
And you'll find that if you instantiate, or if you make an OCaml exception and print it out to the console, what you get is the name of the, you get an array of two things, the name of the exception and then some magic number. And I don't know what it means.
Right.
So like if you make an exception that's called like request too big error or something like that, and you print it out, you'll see in the console an array that has request too big error, (8) or something. And I'm like, I don't know what that number is.
Right.
I think it's an important number.
So that number is redundant in that case.
Okay.
The number is basically the enum int, if you're familiar. So you know, if you're making a some type with several constructors, the runtime representation will have an integer for each one of them.
Okay.
The first one defined is
zero
or one. I forget whether it's one indexed. And then the next one's two, the next one's three.
So
And that's what, you know, when you switch on something, the JavaScript that it turns into is check the tag. If it's one, then go here. If it's two, then go here.
I see. That makes sense.
And so with the exceptions all have, you know, each exception type has a unique ID integer. And that is what's getting printed out along with the name. It's nice that the name's held onto.
So I ran into a nasty bug the other day involving that number.
Okay.
And I don't have the answer for it still. But what happened was I was trying to handle an exception, a JSON decoding exception.
Okay.
So I did a switch and I did the value and then on the next line, X, and like you'd match on the
right.
exception. And I deconstructed JSON.decode.decodeError. I've done this before and it's
right.
worked. In this specific case, it was never hitting that branch. And I went into the actual JavaScript code and I debugged at runtime. Oh, that's another thing we should talk about in a minute is runtime debugging.
Right.
So I did a debugger at runtime and I actually was getting a JSON decode exception, but the number for my specific circumstance was different from the number that gets signed inside the library. So somehow I got in a different instance of the JSON decode constructor and it wasn't matching in the switch branch.
Wow.
And I didn't know what to do. So I just like aborted and went a different path.
Oh, so that's, I think that is NPM come to bite you.
Thanks NPM.
Where, you know, in JavaScript node modules, you're allowed to have multiple copies of the same library.
Oh.
And if you've done things with React and had ever had multiple copies of React in your project and it
that's nasty.
Dies in fire, this is the same kind of idea. So I imagine there are maybe two copies of, if you're using a library, then that library, or maybe two copies of BS Platform. That would be scary.
Sure.
You know, the BuckleScript compiler just sees two ML files and says, okay, this one defines a new exception, this one defines a different new exception.
You think that the global namespace would have a collision, though? Or if I made a library called JSON decode in my own source, would that just override the library? Like, is it last initializer wins module-wise?
BuckleScript really should yell at you. I think it does.
I've never had a yell at me before yet.
If you have multiple copies of the same, or if you have multiple modules with the same name.
Like if you define a module called Belt, I think it just gets mad when you try to use stuff from Belt that doesn't exist.
That's true. Maybe it is the last one defined.
So watch out for that then. If you're using, you know, modules that could collide, or if you have the chance to have multiple copies, maybe you're going to end up with collisions.
Right. Yeah. So, it seems like there should be sanity checking on that.
Pretty weird that I would have my switch come from one library and the source of the error come from another one. But I mean, that would definitely make sense.
Right.
Okay. So I'm getting a little in the weeds because what I want to treat is like the overall error handling approach.
Right.
So, my problem here is that I'm developing this whole server. Something would go, I'd get a 500, you know, I'd throw an exception somewhere in the server.
Sure.
And I would get this error that says like maybe I made my own exception that said like GraphQL request failed. Right.
Right.
I'm like, oh, thanks. One of my 500 GraphQL requests failed. And I have no idea which one.
And you don't get a traceback.
And no traceback. There's no file where, you know, like, oh, this thing called the GraphQL thing, et cetera. So, and 500 was an exaggeration.
Sure.
So, you know. So this was driving me crazy because it was really hard to debug
stuff.
So I went and read a bunch of things, and there's like JS exception, where there's basically on the reason site, they give you two options. They're like, you can use JS exception if you want to. But they say kind of like, but the idiomatic reason way is to use results and
sure.
And like handle your things when they fail.
Right.
And I'm like, well, that's great, but I actually really do like the idea of propagating errors up, you know, in the sense that, or like being able to throw, right?
Sure.
And have the request fail with a 500 and then get that log. Mm-hmm. Have the middleware handle it, say, okay, I see that there something got thrown. I'm going to log the trace back and I'm going to give a 500. That's kind of like the accepted way to do it. I don't know if that's right.
Sure.
That's what I was used to. So what I ended up doing, it's funny because I ended up kind of doing a weird hybrid, but I was like, well, okay, but basically what I need is like my own callback system, my own like, not callback, but my own, stack trace system. I tried to use the built-in stack traces. You can, like, what I tried to do was make a library where, if there were a failure, it would actually instantiate a JavaScript, JavaScript error, which would give me a stack trace.
Okay.
And then I'd like chop off the first couple of lines, which right. was my, you know, the library that generated the stack traces.
Sure.
That was okay.
Okay.
It wasn't amazing though.
Right.
So what I ended up doing was implementing a whole new type called future, which is an unfailable promise. So cool. It's a nested promise with result in it.
Right.
So a future is a promise with a result inside and a fixed error type. So,
okay.
So basically you end up with something kind of like promise, where you have like promise of user, for example.
Right.
You'd have a future of user.
Right.
But in the error type, you have basically like an accumulated string of events that have happened on the way up to this user, if that makes sense. So instead of a call stack, I get breadcrumbs, if that makes sense.
That's kind of cool.
So like, yes, I mean, I'm not sure how useful it's been yet, but sure. it is interesting because when I get a failure, like a 500, I actually can go through and follow along the whole path that this future took until it got to the place where it failed.
That's actually, I feel like I have wanted that a lot more than I've wanted call stacks.
A stack trace.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Because, yeah, I don't want, because a stack trace is what are the places that would happen after this exception? If that makes sense. So it is, this function would return to this call site, yes. which would return to this call site. So it's kind of the potential future as opposed to how did I get here?
Yeah, that's a good
what happened in the past? And those can be different in important ways where it's like, you know, I got this undefined value from these three function calls that succeeded. But they're no longer the call stack because it went in and it came out
right.
and gave me the undefined and now I'm here.
Yes. Yeah.
So that's fascinating.
So what I got, so what I have now is like literally a string concatenated with double colons.
Sure.
And it'll say something like authenticated user. So like it'll go through my authentication middleware. And every time I instantiate a future or convert a promise to a future, I made it so that you have to include a line describing what was happening, a string. So cool. It's like, if you have a promise and you say to future,
yeah.
which turns a promise into a future, it takes this string and when the promise fails, it'll stick that breadcrumb in there. So you get this line that's like authenticated the user, fetching the user from such and such a source. And then like,
right.
And then like decoding user. So you get those three things and then you see this decoder error, right? So you get an actual OCaml exception, says decoder right. error, and any accompanying exception info with it. But mm-hmm. then you also get this breadcrumb. So that made it a lot easier for me to see what was actually failing because I could see, oh,
totally.
It was going through and like putting the. Now, I also ended up making my exceptions richer as well. So,
okay.
So when I threw, I would know kind of exactly where that happened. So I'm not so sure how totally practical that the trails have been yet, and that's partially because I also do a lot of mapping and flat mapping over future.
Sure.
And when I do that, I just add onto the trail map or flat map. So right. you'll see like did this map, flat map, and then some other string. So
right.
maybe I just need to be more verbose in it to be like super cool and useful. But it's an interesting start, and it was interesting to implement. I mean, it took me a number of hours to implement sure. it, but it's been useful up till now.
It seems like you could, instead of having breadcrumbs of human specified strings, you could just stick the stack trace of where that to future was called by creating a JavaScript exception in the to promise function, and then hanging on to that stack trace in case the promise fails. It'd probably be a little bit more overhead, but then
could be worthwhile.
then you'd know exactly what map was called, you know, where was it?
Yeah, that's a good point. That's really interesting. Or even there's an interesting global variable defined, which is __loc, which you don't have to, that actually inserts the line and the file name
right
at compile time.
In JavaScript?
Yeah.
Right.
It'll do the compiled JavaScript stuff, right. Not the reason stuff.
Right.
The problem is, like, I always want to be able to say, like, invoke a function and then have that function call loc for the place where it was invoked.
Right.
But it only works for actually inserting that token.
Totally.
So it would be a pain because every time you called it, you'd have to do __loc kind of thing.
Right.
So you could do a PPX to resolve it, but...
Right.
I'm trying to not get into writing PPXs because I feel like I'd spend a lot of time.
Yeah, it's a rabbit hole. It can complicate things quickly.
So that's kind of where I went with the error handling.
Okay.
It's like pseudo call stack, but more like breadcrumb style error handling and implementing my own thing, which are called futures. Now, my whole project uses futures instead of promises. Mm-hmm. Just at the boundaries, I'll do a thing that returns a promise and then I'll turn it into a future.
Right.
That's turned out pretty well. But I am curious to know from other people, how would you solve this problem? I mean, how, and you, Jared, like if you just, would you just use promises with results and like your endpoint would, I'm sorry, you'd have an error handling middleware that just always takes a result. And if you get a failure result and you give a 500, but then how would you have a stack trace that said where it failed? Or would you just...
Sure.
Another approach is to just every time you have a possible failure, make a super specific error to that place so that you're never having like generic GraphQL error, right?
Right, right. So to clarify I feel like there are several different questions in here. One of them is how do we deal with the fact that OCaml exceptions don't give us a stack trace?
Yeah.
Is that...
Yeah. How do we know where it failed?
Yeah. And it kind of seems like it would be nice if BuckleScript just
did that.
Added a stack trace like a normal...
Yeah.
You know. Right. Okay.
Like, because JavaScript.
Right.
Because we're used to that.
Right? Yeah. And I imagine this was... knowing Bob and knowing the BuckleScript mantra, I imagine this was done in the name of performance and efficiency.
Makes
where
sense.
It's like there's extra overhead to allocating an error and getting a stack trace off of it. But you know, maybe you could turn it off for I don't know, like the core, the belt functions or whatever, but then all user code has this turned on by default and you can suppress it with an attribute or something.
Yeah.
Because it certainly is jarring when you're like, oh, an error happened. Why do I not know where it came from?
Zero
like,
idea.
This is ridiculous.
Because a lot of times they come from the libraries.
Right. Yeah. And yeah. So, and then another part of the question, I think what you led out with was, what's the philosophy of error handling, right? Exceptions or results.
Right.
And
it's clear in Elm because there are no exceptions,
right.
Only results.
Right.
And it's clear in JavaScript because there are only exceptions. So
right.
What do you do when you have both?
Yeah. I like Rust's approach.
Teach me, O wise Rustation.
Yeah, there are a lot of things when I'm working in Reason where I'm like, oh, Rust has thought about this. That, you know, the really smart people behind Rust have been working on this for a while and they've come up with an elegant solution. So in Rust, you can throw exceptions, but you can't catch them.
What?
It's called a panic.
Okay.
And it's basically saying, if you want to crash the program, you're allowed to, but you can't use exceptions for handling things that are not truly exceptional, truly unexpected.
Okay, so exceptions are only for panic crash.
Yeah.
Zero, non-zero exit code, my server is exiting,
right.
All requests aborted.
Right.
Interesting. Okay.
Which allows you to have some of the fast and loose, I don't want to pipe everything through, but then when you get down to it, it's like it nudges you toward the more principled
handle
route.
It.
Yeah. you should be dealing, if this is like a, this will probably happen, then you should handle it as opposed to panicking.
Okay.
And so I like that philosophy. We're going to talk about let anything later, and that helps a lot with the plumbing of things through, where normally using results is kind of a hassle because you've got to do a switch everywhere. But this little syntax sugar can help with that.
Or you've got to just always, you know, map and flat map. You don't always have to switch necessarily.
Right.
Let's say that we're in the circumstance where we're like four or five levels deep and we're going to fetch a thing and decode it. And instead of letting the decode raise an exception, like I'm doing right now, what if we just change, like we wrap the JSON decode library to always return a result, right?
Yeah.
And then we always get a result of X. Well, then probably I'm not going to actually handle that result until much higher up, because in a lot of these cases, I can't continue if the result is a failure, right?
Sure. And if it's a thing where, you know, truly you want to 500, I think exceptions are probably reasonable.
Okay.
I want to go back to the top level of my app. Because there's nothing I can do.
That doesn't happen a lot in React apps and front end stuff, right? Because you often want to handle and be nice and say like, okay, well, if the user ID doesn't exist, I'll show them this nice dialog box that says you're not logged in or whatever.
Right.
But on the server, in the context of a single request, you often just say like, you have one thing to do, and if you don't have that piece of information, you can't do your thing.
Right.
And so you say, I'm out 500. You know.
Yeah. It does. So I definitely bias toward using results just about everywhere because it feels so much safer. If my mantra is pretty much never throw an exception, I don't have to worry about not having caught it.
Okay.
But
you still do have to worry about the other problem, which was, where did I fail my result? Right? Where did my result failure come from?
Right.
And so you get a JSON decode failure.
Right.
And where did you handle that? Especially, this is a nice actually transition into let anything.
Yeah.
Which we'll introduce in a second. But if you're using let anything, then you're not switching. You're just saying, oh, I'm in my context of my results. So I'm going to let result. And then, you know, like two or three functions up, since they all are returning results, then you end up with a failure and you don't know why. You don't know that it's function.
Right.
X two levels down that was decoding that failed, because you just get a decoding failure. You're like, but okay, which decoding, you know, failure kind of thing.
Right. And so with that, I try to, also be principled there and transform the error, at places that make sense. Right. So, I call this thing that will return a result, and this function has five or six different things that will return results. Basically, if I'm in
result
a function
steps.
And I know that there are several different places that will return the same error, essentially, such that it wouldn't be clear, then I'll transform that error when I get it using a try block with the try part of let anything. And then I can say, I'll give a clearer error message for this.
Interesting. So the try is interesting, because that's like, is that map error or is that
it's map error. It's bind error.
Before we continue, let's explain the library.
Yeah.
I want to dig deeper into it. Do you want me to explain it, or you explain it? You're the author.
I'll try explaining it, and you can tell me that it doesn't make sense.
Okay.
So let anything is me implementing a I made a pull request to Reason that was adding some async await sugar that would work for more than just promises, but also results and options and a bunch of different use cases where you want to avoid nesting and things like that. And there was a bunch of discussion on it and back and forth, you know, what's the best way to do it? And I thought, if I implement this as a in user land as a library, then I can test it out. Some other people could test it out and kind of gain more confidence that this makes sense as a syntax change, because it's, you know, it's a big thing to change the syntax. Let's be confident about it. So what it looks like is it feels kind of like async await, where if you say you want to make a variable that is the result of a promise, then you can do let percent async person equals person promise. And then you can write the rest of your code as though it happens synchronously, right? So it's the same kind of idea as with async await, where you write the code sequentially and it will happen asynchronously.
Because it transforms the code into a callback style under the covers.
That's right. And if you're familiar with async await and the promises that it turns into, it's basically the same thing. The syntax was also inspired by F sharp, which has an async await like thing. But basically it allows you to not only say, I want to let X equals the result of this promise. You can also say let X equal the value of this optional if it's there. If it's not there, then it's almost like an early return, where like basically the result of this block will be a none.
Yeah.
Which is something that you really, really want when you have a bunch of different things that are optional. If you're doing parsing, or you're like, here are all these different things that might be null, and I only want to continue if all of them are there. It really cleans up the code.
Yeah, it's great. And for those who are curious, this is tapping into the monad design pattern from Haskell and from functional programming, where you have some container that holds a value, and you're able to tap into that container, and the flatmac function is going to tap into that container, run a function on the value of the container, and return another container and flatten it down. So there's only one level of containers. That's flatmap, also called bind. And this concept that we're talking about with async await, or the code flattening, is also available in languages like Haskell called denotation, or in languages like Scala with their for comprehensions. Like, this is a pretty common pattern.
Yeah.
The catch with your, not the catch, but the way your PPX works, which is, I love that it's actually just a code transformation. Like, you can reason through what's happening, because you know that when you make this let percent async equals thing that returns a promise, you know that everything after that is just getting nested in a callback.
Right.
That's just how it works.
Yeah.
And one part that didn't get explained that you were probably heading toward, and I probably cut you off, was you implement your own module. So when you said let percent async, that's not special. Let percent async looks for a module called async in the scope of your project. And inside of that module called async, there needs to be a function defined with a certain signature. Actually, not a certain signature, just a certain name.
Yeah.
Which is let underscore.
Yeah. So let percent async x equals y transforms literally into async dot let underscore y comma x as a function argument arrow, and then the rest of the body.
So anything that takes a callback is going to work with this.
Yeah.
Like, anything that can be changed into a thing that takes a value and return and has a function that's called on it.
Yeah. So I have an implementation that works with let anything that just uses node style callbacks.
Awesome.
So I don't need to wrap anything in a promise. It's just, this is a function that expects a callback at the end, and it all works.
I should have thought of that. That's awesome. That's brilliant. So it just so happens as well that since so many of us use promises, this works really well for promises and for mapping over promises. It also works really well for anything else that's kind of monadic and follows the monad pattern, which is option is one of them. Result is another one of them. There are a whole lot of data structures. Oh, list is another one of them.
Right.
There are a whole lot of things you can map and flat map over. And it's just trivially easy to make a module that defines let underscore. Like, it's just so fast. In fact, in many cases, if you did want to use let anything. And let's say you wanted to, hold on, now I'm going to, yeah. So like, let's say you wanted to have a, this, let's get a little bit crazy here because it starts doing multiple executions for items in the code, but it's kind of cool to think about. So like if you did let percent list, right? And you'd have to define your own module. So like let percent let list. It's getting confusing to explain on the radio, but you have your own module that's not clashing with the list module, right? But let's say you say like let percent let list equals, and then you pass in a list of things to it. Then everything in the code that comes after that line would be called with, it would be called for each item in the list if you implemented it that way.
Right.
So like if you did, and if you did that, then list map, the implementation there is just list.map. I'm sorry. Let list, your module. Oh, this is so bad. Let list, the implementation could just be list.map. So for many of these things, you can just implement let anything by just saying, oh, like option. Let's say I want to use option. Then all I do is say, like mine is called opt. I usually just like shorten the thing. So I say like let percent opt equals an option. And the implementation of that is literally just like belt.option.map.
Right.
Or dot flat map actually in yeah. this case.
Yeah. And so if you're excited about monads, you can definitely go down a pretty deep rabbit hole.
Yeah.
I like how, or I designed let anything to be kind of a trying to hit a sweet spot of how difficult it is to define new things, because you can kind of go a little bit wild with your transforms such that it really makes the code harder to read.
Hog wild.
And so there were other,
so don't do that.
There were other proposals on in the thread on the pull request that were like, well, we should make it a lot easier. What if you could just reference any function? What if you, like, it's annoying to make a new module? And I explored that a little bit. Other people explored it, and turns out if you start calling it with just random functions, then like your expectations about the execution order of your code just goes out the window, and you have to spend a lot of time like, wait, so what? What does this function do? So really, I think the sweet spot is only use it for a couple of well-known things. I kind of discourage using it for list comprehensions. I think that will break too many people's assumptions about what code does.
I'll back that up. I've seen list comprehensions in action, and for me, they're kind of like questionably useful because they really kind of make you bend your way that your brain
yeah.
works.
Yeah. I think if you use it for promises, use it for results and options. And maybe that's it. Maybe there are some other, I'm sure your future thing, which is basically a promise, but better, works well. But before you reach for this, you want to think real hard about, is there a very obvious, thing that will happen that most people looking at this will be like, oh yeah, I understand what this is doing. Right. If not, then just write the extra switch statement or whatever.
That makes sense. Right? So basically, like, the guideline would be if you have an abstraction that like holds a value.
Yeah.
Like one value.
Right.
Then maybe that's going to be the best way to move forward.
Yeah.
With this. And especially if it looks like async await, where a lot of people have experience with that already.
Exactly.
Good introduction. we were actually going to talk about the error handling, the map error part of that, because there's more.
Oh, that's right.
You can do more than just let, right? You can do try as well.
Yeah, those are the two things, because I tried using it with just let and some other people as well, and they came back and said, well, actually, Murphy, were one of the people that said, wait, how do I catch an exception in this promise? And my answer at the time was, well, there's no special syntax for it. You just do a promise.catch, and you have to use it that way.
I was like, that's gross.
But yeah, after a couple of people came to me with that, and they were like, well, with JavaScript async await, you can just do a try catch like normal and it works. And it turns out it wasn't too much more work, and I don't think too much more abstraction to allow you to do a try, which Reason already has a try-catch block, and just to annotate the try as well with this same async or result or option, such that actually option wouldn't make any sense because option doesn't have an error case. So you wouldn't really be able right. to implement that in a way that people would expect.
But like result.
Yeah. So result is easy. And so try percent result, my function call catch, and then you do the catch block, and you can basically map on the errors that will be on the result side.
So I'm trying to remember the example you have on the repo right now. I read through it a number of times, and I had a hard time kind of like understanding. I actually came and talked to you about it too, understanding exactly what the use case should be, because right. there's like recover from an error, and then there's map error, right? Right. So result, I think it may be the thing you had done was, I can't remember if it was an option. It might've been an option example, which is maybe why it was confusing.
Right. Yeah. So with the try percent module, in the error handling part, you're allowed to return an okay or an error, right? So it is the monadic bind on the error side of things.
So in that case, it's basically, if you're doing it with results, it's not so much map error as recover, right? Because
right.
you're given a failure, like you're given an exception, right?
Yeah. And then you're allowed to return a new exception if you just want to transform that into a different exception, or you can return the a default case.
I see. So try is actually handling an exception, not a failure, right?
It is.
Let's say you do let percent result
right.
blah equals try percent result, and then you pass in a block. What are you going to be matching on? You're not going to be matching on the result constructors, right?
You'll be matching on the contents of the error side.
Oh, you will?
Yes.
I thought you'd be matching on an exception. Okay.
So if you have a result and the value side is a string and the error side is an int.
Sure, yeah.
Then what you're matching on are the different integers.
Yes, okay, that makes sense.
And then you can return a new error, and you can return an error that is of a different kind if you want.
It could be a string.
And this is, say, in the case where you call a function that does GraphQL things and returns a result that either has your object or a string that just kind of maybe is the GraphQL error. But the function that you're in expects more structured errors. Maybe you've got an error type with a couple of different constructors. You can, you know, say error and then the constructor with the contents of the GraphQL error or something.
That makes a lot of sense. So I could have my JSON decode library that wraps the other JSON decode. And when I do it, it actually returns a result of either the thing or an exception, like, or a JSON decode error, right?
Sure.
And then in that case, I could use the let comprehension on the result
mm-hmm.
and I could get out the error, and that's where you're saying I could transform the result. And so instead of saying like, oh, just JSON decode error, I could log if I wanted to, for one thing. I could do a side effect log, but I could just say, oh, failed because I couldn't decode the user while trying to update their password or something.
Yeah,
like that.
Yeah. And I should do a blog post that is just kind of going through a bunch of different useful constructs that come out of the let anything syntax, because you can do early returns, like kind of guard statements. You can transform errors. You know, the default case is to transform the result, the value. There's a lot of different stuff.
It's a lot of cool stuff. So I think I get that a lot better now. That makes a lot more sense. Try.
Yeah.
I wasn't using that very much, but now I think that could be a really sensible answer to my error handling question as well, because a lot of cases right now it's just like, let it fail, oh, sorry, you know,
right? Yeah. And again, you write try percent module transforms into, you know, async dot try underscore
yeah
in the same kind of fashion, except it will the expectation is that you will call the function on the error value as opposed to the happy value.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So it's trying to be a very thin layer so that there's really not much magic.
Yeah.
Maybe there's some thinking through when you're like, oh, how do I implement the try underscore or the let underscore? But once you've done that, it doesn't take too much jumping jacks to figure out, okay, what's happening here.
So you wouldn't match on the result. You would only match on the failure case.
That's right.
So would you match on the contents of the failure case?
Yes.
I see. So you would match on, like you said, I'm sorry, I was a step behind. You wouldn't match on like error integer. You would match on just integers.
You're right.
That's brilliant.
Yeah.
I like it.
So it's kind of piggybacking on a current reason construct, where that gives you this matching thing for free. And so the most comfortable looking way is if your error is a type, that has various constructors.
Yeah.
And so you can match on the individual constructors. If your error is just a string, then you're probably not going to match on the individual strings. You'll just do, pipe, exception name, and then transform that into something else.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Or if it's a promise error, then it's just going to be error as well.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, I've learned a lot, and I'm going to change some of the way that my code works because I think that'll help a lot. I think that being able to specifically handle certain errors easily in places makes a lot of sense. And I mean, I'm thinking about some of the extra typing that goes into that, like literally hitting the keys.
Right.
But then I think about the poor Go people who just always do the super verbose error handling, and they're happy, So
yeah.
I can be happy as well.
Yep. Yeah.
I can be happy with more explicit stuff. Okay. So let's get real deep now that we've gotten a little deep and talk.
I thought we were deep already. Where are we going?
We're getting deeper into, close your ears, monad transformers.
Okay, that's right, because you have a future, you have a promise with a result inside of it.
Yes.
And you want to handle both at the same time.
Yeah, or let's simplify that a little bit and go with the case of a promise with an option in it, because that happens a lot. Right?
Okay.
So let's say you're like trying to fetch a user, and the user may or may not exist.
Right.
And so you want to work with the fact that there's a promise that you want to map over because it's going to happen in the future, and this option that you want to map over and say like only continue on forward if this user exists.
Sure.
So your code without the let stuff would be like, okay, go ahead and say, or I'm sorry, without
let anything?
If you're just using let anything on promises, then you would say let promise. You need to unwrap the value of the promise, and then you'd get this maybe user. And then you'd use a switch, and you'd say switch maybe user, case none, blah, case some, blah.
Right.
Maybe that's fine, but maybe it's not just the user. Maybe you also want to like get the user's real name, and that's an optional.
Right.
And so you end up with like future, or you get promise option. Option.
Oh yeah.
Or even worse, let's say you get the user, and then you want to go get their friend list.
Right.
Maybe they don't have any friends, right? So you end up with promise option, promise option.
Yeah, yeah.
That gets pretty nasty. And so in other languages like Haskell, when you're using do notation, Haskell is very much geared toward abstraction and generic abstraction. Like
totally.
Like the idea in Haskell is like abstraction first. Where you say, here's a monad. All of my data structures and all of my tools and libraries, you go ahead and implement monad if you're going to offer that kind of behavior.
Right.
And so in Haskell, you have like IO, which that's a library. That data type implements monad. And you have maybe, I don't remember if it's called that, but.
Right.
What you end up with is they need a new abstraction to handle the combination of two monads.
Right.
So it's not just easy enough. It's not as easy as saying like, oh, well, if the option is a none, then go ahead and fail my promise. Like that's, it seems easy because that's what you would just want that. Right. But in Haskell, you'd have to say like, oh, like lift IO, like there, you have to get more specific. But if you go and read the Haskell book, like the chapter on monad transformers will just melt your ears and your brain and your eyes. Like I tried, and it was it was so hard.
Yeah.
But the concept is actually rather simple. Basically, what you want is just to say, if in this case where I can't continue forward and I like, if the user doesn't exist, I'm going with nothing, right? If the user's friends don't exist, the specific task that I'm going for is going to also be a nothing. Like,
right.
In the case where I'm like three or four levels deep, and if any of these fail, I'm going to end up with a nothing, which happens sometimes, and the code can get really gnarly. Then what you can do is say, make a new module called like promise opt, and just implement the combination of a promise and an option.
So you're collapsing the promise and the option almost.
Yes. And so by hand, you're doing a combination.
Right.
And so you don't need monad transformers anymore. You just need a new let function that handles an option within a promise.
Yeah.
And then if you end up with like promise option, then you might need to handle an option within a promise, or you might need like promise opt, and you also might need opt promise. You might need to switch those off depending. So if you're like,
sure.
If you're like in, maybe not, I haven't thought that through very well. You might actually only need promise and promise opt, because that's probably actually the case.
Right. Cause you can collapse two promises and
you can collapse an opt into a promise.
Right.
Cause what you would end up with in this case is you would say like, you'd await the promise, and then you would say, well, if the user's not there, then you just fail the promise. And then you go in, like, let's say the user is there. Okay, well, that's great. Then you do this other promise. Okay, that promise fails, then you fail the promise. And then you're like three levels in, and you're like, okay, well, their friends don't exist. So then you fail the promise, and it all collapses down into one nice, neat thing.
Right.
Could you combine it the other way? Could you have the option be the outside layer and the promise be the inside layer?
I don't think you. If you had code such that you were like, I might have a promise.
Yeah. Right.
And I want to get the value of the promise if I have it. Then you would do it the opposite way.
Yes.
As opposed to
I might not.
Right.
Right.
The example that you gave of, I want to get, I have a promise that might have a value, and I want to get the value of the result of the promise if it's there.
That's going to be the much way more common.
Right, I imagine.
I don't even know when you would run into a time where you're like, well, I might have a promise, I might not.
Yeah, right, that
doesn't seem very regular.
Yeah. So one of the other things, and this isn't going to work very well over audio, but... you can even avoid that level of abstraction using blocks, where you and basically, if you're going from one kind of monad to another kind of monad, and you're like, okay, at the top level of my function, I've got all these promises, and then I'm gonna deal with options for a while. You can just add a set of curly braces and do your let opt inside there. And then the result of that curly braces will be an option, and you can switch on that.
Yeah, that's good too. I like that.
And so that that is great for one-offs where it's like, I don't want to make another module to handle this specific combination.
Right.
But I do want, you know, I'm doing this enough times that I want to be able to have the nice syntax.
Yeah, I like that. So that would be useful if you're, like you said, you're doing a bunch of promises and then you're doing a bunch of opts.
Right.
In the case where you're doing promise opt, promise opt, promise opt, you probably want to do that combination module.
Yeah.
Which makes sense. And so just to make the show notes make a little bit of sense, we dropped in there Goldilocks abstraction, I think is what we called it.
That's right.
And the thought there is like, you can go very far with abstraction to the point where you want to be generic to handle everything. I haven't found in my experience that that's often super useful at my level of programming. I'm not a language designer. At my level of programming where I'm just getting things done, usually for me it's like the Goldilocks abstraction where I'm like, I don't want to type all the code out. I do want to use abstractions, but I don't necessarily need my abstraction to be generic enough to handle every case. And that's something that when I ended up doing the future library, that was kind of a Goldilocks abstraction for me, because I did search on Redux on the
sure.
Redux package repo, and there are a number of promise alternatives, and they strive to be very generic, where you can have, you know, like your future value can contain anything, and the failure value can contain anything, and then like
right.
It gets pretty complex. And I was like, well, you know what, my failure value is always going to be the same. This is what it is. And my, so then I can simplify this because I'm always I'm going to always handle promises,
right,
wrap them as futures, and my failure is always going to be the same. And so by Goldilocksing the abstraction, I simplified my code because I just cut out other possibilities and said, it's abstract enough to handle different values in the value side. And that's enough for me.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm totally with you on that. I feel like the times when I have gotten really excited about an abstraction, first of all, I was wrong. Like, it was the wrong abstraction. And so, like, it got in the way. Or, you know, I built out all this functionality that never got used. Like, in the Khan Academy iOS app, our number one source of bugs is an overly exuberant, layout manager thing that allows you to have that tries to handle any number of rows on the home on the main screen in any order and all these things, and there are so many crashes that have come from it when it's just like, there are only three things and they're always in the same order, like, let's just hard code this. So
be Goldilocks with your abstraction.
That's right.
Unless you're a language designer.
And then you can, you know, go into your hammock and think for a long time.
Yeah.
And maybe come up with the right one.
Love it. Hammock-driven development.
Okay.
We got through a lot of stuff.
Oh, there was one question about code sharing, but maybe we'll have to wait till next time.
Oh, yeah. And I also wanted to plug Convox, too.
That's right.
So on the topic of server stuff again, I talked in previous shows about having to bundle your code up a bunch. That was a huge pain. And then I was like, well, maybe Elastic Beanstalk made it better because I'll just use CI to build stuff. And I ended up using Docker hosting, where I just build a Docker container. I don't really care that the OCaml executable is in there because when I deploy, that only gets pulled once and then it's cached. So it's not that big of a deal for me. Right. I'm only shipping my new layers when I deploy in the future. So I ended up using this service called Convox, which was recommended to me by a friend on Twitter. And they're basically infrastructure that sits on top of your current AWS account.
Yeah.
And you can use it for free. There's a free tier and you just pay for the AWS hardware.
Right.
And they'll basically stand up like a container host for you on a variable number of boxes and do their best to make the most of your money as well. Like they'll scale your cluster. So basically they make a cluster and then you ship Docker containers to it.
Okay.
They manage all that stuff for you. It's not as involved as a Kubernetes. You don't have to understand the ins and outs of Kubernetes. But they will auto-scale the cluster as needs be. And they'll even use Spot instances, so it's cheaper. I didn't know Spot instances are AWS's, like, this box is unused, but it could go away. So they're cheaper.
Oh, okay.
So it's not a reserved instance, and it's not a on-demand instance either. It's like, this is cheap because we might pull it out from underneath you. But the way this service is built, it's a cluster, so we don't care. Like, if it's gone, we'll just add another, right?
Fancy. Okay.
Yeah, so it could scale up. It can use Spot instances. And then so your app will auto-scale, and the cluster will auto-scale to meet the needs of your app. So that's pretty sweet. And it's worked pretty well. I like it. And I was able to ship my app with minimal pain compared with some of the other things I've done. So I just built a Docker container that just builds my reason code in the Docker container,
mm-hmm.
ships it out, and there you go. I have reason on the server without the headache of bundling. That's super great.
Yeah. I also experimented with Docker recently, trying shipping native reason in a Docker container to now.sh. That also worked really well. I wrote a blog post about it that we can link to.
Now is also, I was doing that initially.
Mm-hmm.
The Docker container size does matter if you're using Now.
Right.
Because you don't have control over, like, the infrastructure and where the images are pulled.
Right.
And part of the way that they have built the new generation of Now is that they really want your app to be pretty ephemeral, and they want to be able to sleep it.
That's
pretty,
right.
And wake it pretty quickly. And so the smaller your app image is, the faster they can wake it.
That's right.
From cold, you know?
Yeah.
So that's great. So you do have to be aware if you're shipping to now of the size of your bundle. So that'll affect the reason thing still, but.
Right. And so the native compilation that I did resulted in a Docker image that was 9 megabytes.
Love it. That's awesome.
So it was perfect for it. If you're doing the JavaScript Node.js and you're shipping best platform, then that of course would get in the way.
Yeah. But if you're doing Reason Native Server, which you shouldn't be doing yet if you're doing anything serious.
Right.
That's way cool.
Yeah.
Have you heard anything on that front? Do you think people are working in that direction?
I don't know. Nothing new necessarily. Okay. I mean, people are playing around, and there are, there's a new OCaml server library that is, benchmarked at being much better scalable than the old OCaml server library. but certainly not anywhere near the usability of Express or anything like that. It's very much a low level, people just kind of trying out different things.
We're a ways out from that still.
Yeah.
It almost seems likely to me that we'd end up having it like a Go compilation target or something. And then, right. And then,
right.
Being able to use Go.
Now that would be interesting.
That would be,
has anybody tried that?
Yeah. Hold on a second.
Compiling to Go, because Go has garbage collection.
Yes. I'm trying to think, we've talked about this before.
Oh, there was a TypeScript with Go.
Yes.
Yeah. So that was JavaScript in Go.
And it was Faded who was, his tree name on Twitter is Faded.
Yeah. So that was, it's still BuckleScript Reason to JavaScript, but then the JavaScript FFI goes to Go bindings as opposed to C++ bindings.
Right.
Or something like that.
Yes.
But I was thinking, there's somebody's working on OCaml to WASM directly.
Yeah.
If I wonder how hard it would be to get OCaml to Go native.
Oh, yeah.
So then you can have a native binary that takes advantage of all of Go's awesome cross compilation and their great standard library.
Yes.
While having a much nicer type system.
I was going to say, you wouldn't have to write Go. Yeah. I'm going to get just rocks thrown in my window for saying
that's
that.
Right.
But I have a really hard time with the lack of generics. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I do.
Yeah.
I do.
It's a struggle.
That would be cool. If someone's going to do that, let us know.
That's right.
But that would be a massive undertaking. That would be like BuckleScript all over again.
Yeah.
So if you're Bloomberg and you're interested in that,
right?
I guess
right?
You can throw a lot of money at it, but
yeah,
that's cool.
Yep.
Okay. Did we beat that topic into the ground?
I think we've checked all the boxes.
Okay. Thanks for listening, everybody. Any last notes, Jared?
No, that's all I've got.
All right. Well, happy October.
Thanks a lot.
Bye.